Welcome to Catholics Across the Aisle, the podcast of the Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops, offering commentary on public policy and civic life. This is Michael Sheedy, Executive Director of the conference. Michael Sheedy, thank you for joining us for Catholics Across the Aisle, a podcast of the Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops. Today, I'm joined by Ingrid Delgado, Associate Director for Social Concerns and Respect Life here at the conference. We're going to be reviewing key activities of the last legislative session for 2021. Ingrid, good to be with you again today.
Good to be here, and I'm glad that we have survived session.
Yes, there was a session unlike previous sessions. They're all different, but boy, with all the COVID protocols and everything, it really changed the dynamics, didn't it?
It did. But we made it through. We had to get creative on how to, you know, reach out to members and talk about the issues that mattered to us, even though our access to the Capitol was very limited.
That's right. I guess to provide testimony at hearings in the Senate, people had to go to the Civic Center, the Tucker Center, to provide testimony. That was an interesting experience, not being in the room and having to wade through the throngs of people there and wait for opportunities. I think you and the other associates and I all had our days in the sun there. That was interesting. And then I guess, you know, there was some scaled back access to members in the House during their committee hearings. You know, they had limited seating. You could get in if you registered, I guess, more than 3 hours in advance. Obviously, capacity was limited, and so you couldn't get in necessarily. So the public's involvement was just different. Well, listen, we won't reflect too much more on what was different. Let's do talk about the policy issues that we engaged in, that you engaged in so well, on behalf of the bishops and the conference, which will be of interest to our listeners. So I know as we got into the session, I think when in our preview for the session, we started off probably talking a little bit about abortion bills. There were a good number of bills that were filed, a 20-week abortion ban, also a disability abortion ban. What happened? Fill folks in.
Sure. So one of our Catholic Days at the Capitol issues this year had been a bill to prohibit abortion after 20 weeks gestation. And of course, you know, our work really is to make abortion illegal and unthinkable completely, right? But we also support incremental improvements in the law. So we did support a bill to prohibit abortion after 20 weeks because there is some research that shows that children at this gestational age, maybe even earlier, can feel pain, have the capacity to feel pain. Unfortunately, those bills were not considered by committee this session, but we do hope that they will be filed again in the future and that they will gain some traction next session. However, there was still some attention to the abortion issue this session, and that was for a bill prohibiting abortion if the sole reason for that abortion is a fetal anomaly. That bill was considered by two committees in the House. It did pass the full House chamber, but it did not move at all in the Senate.
Yeah, it was an interesting debate, I'd say. You know, a child could be aborted for any other reason. I mean, if it's more convenient for the mom or a parent in their eyes to abort the child, they could do it for that reason. But just if the only reason was because the child was disabled, then it would become illegal. And I guess there's some activity in other states to adopt similar laws.
There has been, right. Other states have worked on these, you know, issues, both, right, the 20 weeks bill and the disability abortion law. The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't considered either yet, but we'll watch that, right, because it could invite the U.S. Supreme Court to revisit some kind of previous decisions based on, you know, prohibiting abortion after viability. But I'll also say that even though the bill would only prohibit abortion when a child has been, you know, diagnosed with a fetal anomaly, right, so for socioeconomic reasons, the mother could still abort, right, for elective reasons, for no reasons, the mother could still abort. But it really opened up some great discussion about how we as a society talk about people with different abilities, right? And so maybe indirectly as a result, the Persons with Disabilities Agency actually got an increase to remove, you know, many people off of the wait list. So even though the bill wasn't signed into law, I think it really will help to serve people with disabilities in Florida.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, the whole discussion of eugenics really came up in some of that debate, didn't it? Well, I guess if we're going to start with one life issue, maybe go to another one. You know, there were bills again filed that would repeal the death penalty. They did not get traction, but there was still some activity that related to it that would have limited some of the harm.
Exactly. And just like the disabilities abortion bill opened up the conversation around abortion and around disability, same thing, right? So the bills to repeal the death penalty didn't move through committee, but we're very grateful that they were filed. But a different bill exempting those with severe mental illness from the death penalty allowed some great conversation around the death penalty. It only moved through one committee. I was really hopeful it would get at least a second committee hearing because the sponsor was the second committee chairman, but substantive bills had stopped meeting at that point. But I think what's really interesting here is that the bill passed that committee unanimously, right? So people from both major parties and people who actually support the death penalty were able to come together and agree that those with severe mental illnesses should not be sentenced to death.
And that bill sponsor, that committee chair, was Senator Jeff Brandis, am I right?
That's right. He is a friend of the conference on many issues. So we're very thankful for his sponsorship, and we are looking forward for him to sponsor it again next session.
Now, I know that a lot of eyes were turned to addressing some of the unrest that we've seen in our society, you know, over some of the tragic deaths of folks who were in police custody. Some of those prompted a lot of outcry. They prompted a lot of actually demonstrations and unrest. There were some good things that happened, and there's some other things that we're still like not so sure about. But I know that there were some reforms that were enacted to help train police to deal with some of these situations that can often arise in dealing with a large crowd.
Yes. So one bill number is really easy to remember. Number one, right? HB1 was passed and it was signed into law by Governor DeSantis. And so even though the sponsors talked about its intent being to, you know, curb rioting, some of the language in there raised a lot of flags, right? So for example, it increases penalties for things that were already crimes. So of course, we don't support violence or looting, you know, as a result of protests, but things like, you know, assault, battery, and theft, those things were already crimes. So to increase the penalty, number one, was unnecessary, but number two, doesn't really get to the root causes of why there was civil unrest, right? Why people protest. And so, you know, it's important to look at the fact that a lot of recent protests have been an outcry for racial justice and for police reform. So even though that bill passed and there are a lot of concerns around it, thankfully, there was a police reform bill that also passed. And that one passed unanimously, right? Members of both major parties came together for that. And so that bill would limit the use of chokeholds, would require de-escalation training for officers. It also requires that if there have been use of force incidents in the past, that be reported when an officer goes to apply for a new job. It also requires some public data so the public can see if there are use of force incidents. So it was really great to see, you know, members of both parties come together for something like that, even though there was really a lot of tension around the anti-protest bill. And I'll also just quickly mention that because some of the terminology in HB1 was very, very broad, we are in the process of assessing how that could impact some of our public ministries, such as sidewalk counseling and prayer vigils when executions are scheduled.
Good stuff, Ingrid. Thanks very much. And well, you know, since we're talking a little bit about some of these changes to our criminal codes, maybe we should talk a little bit more about just some criminal justice issues as well. I know that there was, again, a lot of activity in that area, kept you busy. There were some things that moved that got some traction, though.
Yes, a lot of criminal justice bills this session, and one that we can celebrate having passed both chambers, has to do with the civil citations of juveniles. So the conference has supported civil citations legislation in past years, but up until now, if a juvenile received a civil citation and completed it, their arrest record would only be expunged for a misdemeanor. So this bill would expand it. So if a child gets a civil citation, completes the program for a felony, they can also have that arrest record expunged. Now, Michael, I think it's really important to talk here that not all crimes are eligible for, you know, civil citations. I think some members had a lot of questions around, like, you know, if a child got, you know, convicted of murder or rape, right? Could they complete a civil citation and have their arrest record expunged? The answer is no, right? So there's a very short and specific list of crimes and violations for which a juvenile can receive a civil citation. And these are great because it really gives young people a second chance to, you know, enlist in the military and go, you know, to college and get, you know, scholarships and things like that. So it's great that if they complete these programs, they can have their arrest record expunged. I'll say that when we had our beginning of session podcast, I was really hopeful about game time reform. It moved a little bit. It passed two committees in the Senate, but it wasn't considered on the floor of the Senate. It wasn't considered in the House at all, but hopefully next session. So what this bill does is that, you know, right now, someone who's incarcerated can earn like good time credit, good behavior credits, up to like 15% of their sentence, right? So they still have to serve 85% of their sentence. But it gets to a point where, you know, folks aren't incentivized to continue being part of programs and schooling and things like that that can really better prepare them to re-enter society. So this bill would allow them to have a higher amount of, you know, good behavior credits, and folks would only be required to serve 65% of their sentence.
That's great. Yeah. The more we can do to get people motivated to succeed when they get outside of prison and maybe even shorten sentences to be reunited with their families and their communities, that's really great stuff.
And if I could just say that, you know, the many volunteers, the Catholic volunteers that are part of prison ministry in Florida, just really have a firsthand account, you know, an opportunity to witness how people really can transform and reform their lives with the proper programming behind bars.
Now, Ingrid, one of the things that we long focus on is affordable housing. And we've been, I guess, charter members of the Sadowski Coalition for Affordable Housing for many years. You do a great job participating with the stakeholders there. You know, we're kind of accustomed to a lot of their funding being rated by the legislature. This year, the dynamic was a little bit different, wasn't it? Some rating, but some also some protection in ways that were unanticipated.
Yeah, this was kind of a mixed bag. It's not ideal, but it's something, right? So in the past, I think it's 15 years, about $2 billion, billion with a B, have been raided from the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. And so every year, you know, the Sadowski Coalition members, the FCCB included, would ask for full funding. And over again, we would get different amounts appropriated towards affordable housing. So we had supported a bill that would prohibit the future rating of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund dollars. So that language did pass both chambers. That's a good thing. That's a success. It's an improvement. Kind of the downside of that is that in the same bill, the formula was changed to calculate doc stamp revenue that would be appropriated to affordable housing. So originally, about 2/3 of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund was going to be reallocated to, you know, some infrastructure and sea level rise type, you know, projects and programs, which we actually supported, right? We just didn't support affordable housing dollars going to those things. But eventually we were able to kind of meet in the middle, and only about half of the doc stamp revenue is going to be reallocated to those programs and projects. So what we're looking at is moving forward permanently, basically the Affordable Housing Trust Fund will get half of the doc stamp revenue that should have gone to affordable housing in the past.
Well, it certainly remains a crisis in Florida that needs to be addressed. I mean, there's not much housing available. Too many people pay way too much of their income for housing. It's certainly an area that hopefully this funding can help to address, but there's certainly going to be a need for other avenues as well.
That's exactly right. You know, and part of what we shared in committee is that so many Floridians are still suffering, you know, as a cause of the pandemic. People have lost their jobs. People have, you know, reduced their income. And so if we were already in an affordable housing crisis, this really is the time to fully fund it and not raid it. But, you know, we're thankful that we met halfway and that future rating will be prohibited.
Now, Ingrid, I know on occasion there are efforts to expand funding for contraceptives, and that was certainly the case this year. There was a big commitment in one of our chambers to create a new funding mechanism, new funding to expand the use of abortifacient contraceptives. And it appeared a couple of different places. And in the end, it did get into the budget, but not as much as we thought it would. But why don't you just highlight sort of how that unfolded?
Sure. So in the 469-page budget, there was one little line item that would have appropriated $8 million of recurring money for the Department of Health to partner with family planning providers in providing hormonal long-acting reversible contraception. There are two types of contraception that fall under this description. One is a hormonal intrauterine device, and one is an implant that goes in the arm under the skin. Both of these have abortifacient mechanisms. It was really interesting that the House rejected this line item, and we thought we had a win, but then it was sprinkled back in. But at least there was a reduction. It was only proposed that a $2 million recurring appropriation go to this program. So the budget has still to go to the governor. The governor can still veto line items. So we will be doing some outreach there, hoping that he does veto it. Just public dollars do not need to go to family planning providers to promote and provide abortifacients.
I guess on the flip side, one good other good development this year around the budget had to do with the Florida Pregnancy Care Network. It typically is allocated $4 million of funding. That was increased slightly this session too, right?
Yes. So we are, again, very, we're thankful for an increase going to the Florida Pregnancy Care Network. The last couple of years, they've received a $4 million recurring appropriation. We have, you know, asked for an increase because thankfully these centers are doing great work in the state of Florida. We just did not think that the COVID year was going to be the year for an increase, but we were pleasantly surprised to see that $500,000 of recurring dollars have been appropriated to FPCN.
That's true. The whole dynamic around the budget really changed a lot this year when more federal funding became available to the state. That really changed the temperature in the legislature, going from anticipated cuts in so many areas in almost every program to actually having money that they were able to set aside in reserves and to fund some things that had previously gone unfunded. So, Ingrid, I know you put a lot into this session. It was an effort of love, and your passion showed throughout, and really congratulate you and thank you for the good work. Is there anything else you want to add just as we wind down this segment?
I'll say that I'm glad we survived it. Session is now behind us. There were many issues on which we engaged. We had some wins. We have some work, you know, for future sessions. But like always, whoever's not already, you know, part of our network, please sign on, because we'll still be watching, you know, if some of these bills are signed into law, if any of these are vetoed. So even though session is behind us, there are still a couple of things that aren't finalized.
Ingrid, you did a lot of great work this year. We'll keep working at it, and may these efforts continue to bear fruit. Well, as we continue our legislative update, our legislative wrap-up, really, for this segment, we'll be speaking with Mike Barrett, our Associate for Education here at the conference, who just finished up his first full session working here at the conference, really working in this legislative process. And it was really quite eventful in a good way, I'd say, overall. I mean, so many things passed were priorities. It's, you know, unprecedented. And I think we have a lot to talk about. So, Mike, happy to have you on here.
It's great to be here, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know that really one of the most important bills that was considered this session was to really expand our state scholarship program. I think a lot of listeners probably know that Florida leads the country in providing parents good choices for their children's education through our many programs. But there's a lot of things that happen to expand those and maybe streamline those. So why don't we start there?
Sure. So, yeah, it was a great year for a great legislative session for school choice, and a large school choice expansion bill passed, sponsored by Representative Randy Fine, and Senator Manny Diaz led the way on that. The bill restructures and streamlines the scholarship programs. Just sort of a little background, there's about 80,000 Catholic school students in the state of Florida, and a little bit over 30,000 of those students are on some form of state scholarship. And what this bill does is it took the McKay and Gardner programs, which are scholarship programs that are specifically set aside for students with various types of disabilities, whether they're learning disabilities or physical disabilities, and took those scholarships and it sort of combined them and placed them into the Family Empowerment Scholarship. And so instead of having five different scholarships, there's now only three. There's the Florida Tax Credit Program, which is eligibility for that program is based on income, and the Family Empowerment Scholarship, which has two separate silos now, so you can become eligible for that scholarship via income or via a diagnosed disability. And then the third scholarship is the HOPE scholarship, which is for students who are bullied in public schools. They can obtain a scholarship to go to a private school.
You know, I know that when they combine those, they also change the income eligibility levels for the Family Empowerment Scholarship and the Tax Credit Scholarship, often known as the Step Up for Student Scholarship. They're the primary manager along with AAA scholarships, but that's gonna impact, make this available to more families, right?
Right, absolutely. So the bill raised the income threshold for both the Florida Tax Credit and the Family Empowerment Scholarship to 375% of the federal poverty level. And what that means is that a family of four that makes just under $100,000 a year will be able to apply for these scholarships. So they'll be eligible. And the income threshold goes up depending on how many children you have. So it'll expand access to a lot of families in Florida. And another great thing that this bill did is it eliminated the prior public school requirement for FES and McKay. And so for both of those scholarships, in order to become eligible, a student would have had to attend public school the year before applying for the scholarship. And so there were a lot of students that were already in private schools that would have been eligible for those scholarships, but for the fact that they already attended private school.
That equity concern was a big one. You know, I have a diligent teacher who identifies a learning disability in a child who's in one of our, say, a Catholic school or another non-public school. And based on everything, objectively speaking, they should be eligible for a scholarship. But for the fact that they're here and then they're faced with the decision about whether to leave, take the scholarship and get those additional resources to help their children, then either return or stay in a different system. So this is great. Kids can stay where they are. They can get the services that they need. A great step forward, I'd say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It will expand access to a lot of new families and students. So it's a great bill, and the legislature really did a great job with promoting this and expanding school choice this session. So we're really excited about it.
Well, I know that the church operates a number of early learning centers across Florida. The conference here actually accredits most of those, I think, if not all of those. And we saw some new legislation that's actually already been signed into law.
That's right. A big voluntary pre-kindergarten or VPK program reform bill passed. It was sponsored by Representative Aaron Grawl and Senator Gail Harrell. And this bill sort of restructures the government oversight of the VPK program. There used to be what was called the Office of Early Learning, which is kind of separate from the Department of Education. And what this bill does is it takes the Office of Early Learning and moves it into the Department of Education. It becomes a division of early learning. And the positive of that is it'll streamline a lot of the government oversight of the VPK program and help to also promote oversight of the early learning coalition. So there's, I think, 30 different early learning coalitions throughout the state of Florida, and they help run the BPK programs or oversee the BPK programs in the various regions of the state. And so the bill really does a great job of streamlining the government oversight of the program. And then it also adds greater accountability for BPK providers by kind of restructuring the way that providers are assessed by the state, and creating a new coordinated screening and progress monitoring program, which will provide, it's basically a BPK assessment that will begin to provide better data on student progression during their time in BPK, and help students, families, providers, and the Department of Education be able to better determine how students are progressing during their time in BPK and whether or not they're ready to enter kindergarten. And it's interesting, this bill actually pairs with another bill that was sponsored by Representative Lupus that tracks reading progress from BPK all the way through third grade in public schools. And so it's a sort of a revamping of tracking reading progress for students throughout BPK and then early grades in elementary school.
You know, I'm just reflecting back on the session and this particular bill, Mike, I know that I guess historically it seems that Catholic schools, Catholic early learning centers seem to be more open to greater accountability than some of our counterparts, you know, among other non-public school stakeholders. So it's been interesting just to see how that played out. But we feel pretty comfortable about the fact that, you know, there are accountabilities that are needed and that we can meet those requirements. And it's going to be really a better thing for young children in our care. So a lot of good work there shepherding this through and helping with that. Some great sponsors for sure who really worked hard. Well, I know that the parents of high school students, you know, are probably aware of the option for kids to get into the dual enrollment classes. You know, they can get credit at the high school level, but also get college credit for classes that they take in colleges. And it's interesting because, you know, for homeschool students and students in public schools, the costs have been covered for the families and for the schools. But that's not been the case for those students who are in non-public schools and private schools. But that's changing, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. It's been, this is my first session, but I've heard the history of trying to get this dual enrollment bill across the finish line. And it finally happened this year. Yeah. So public school students and homeschool students have broad open access to dual enrollment courses, and they're free at public colleges and universities. Private school students have not had as much access since about 2012. There's a change in the law that basically said that schools and colleges and universities cannot pass the cost of dual enrollment onto the student. But what happened is the schools and the colleges and universities were left to negotiate the costs, and it was difficult to determine who would cover those costs. A lot of times the colleges and universities didn't want to cover the costs, and it's really cost prohibitive for most private schools to be able to cover the costs of dual enrollment because it's really expensive to provide a wide access of dual enrollment to your students. And so the result of that was that most private school students did not have much access at all to dual enrollment courses. And so this session, Representative Wyman Duggan and Senator Ray Rodriguez sponsored a bill that establishes the dual enrollment scholarship program. And what that does basically is it sets up a separate fund whereby the public colleges and universities will get reimbursed for the cost of tuition and instructional materials for private school students who take dual enrollment courses. So this will broaden access for private school students so that they will have the same type of access to dual enrollment that public school students and homeschool students currently have.
Well, I'd say it it didn't hurt that the sponsor a year ago in the Senate, Kelly Stargell, became the appropriations chair. She could help to make sure that she looked after that. And I think you had a good partner in advocating for this in James Herzog, your predecessor, who now has a role on behalf of the Florida Association of Academic Nonpublic Schools as a legislative liaison coordinator. So kudos to you and to James for working together and seeing this thing through finally. That's a great help. Now, I don't know that most people are aware of what they call Purple Star campuses, you know, for schools. It's something new, but it's something important, and it's something that's going into law as well, we think.
It is, yes. That's another bill that was passed, sponsored by Representative Andrew Learned and Senator Tom Wright. This is a bill that establishes a special program called the Purple Star Campuses Program, and it's this program that is run by the Department of Education that schools can participate in if they serve a large population of military families. And there's a list of requirements that they have to comply with in order to participate in this program. But it basically, the gist of it is that the school is welcoming and inviting and provides certain types of resources to military families and their children in order to help with the transition for students who may have moved several times in their life because their parent is a member of the military. And as they transition into a new school, they have special supports in place to help those students transition seamlessly into their new school. And so this is a great program, and it's open to private schools that accept scholarship students. And this is great because in the new school choice bill that passed, children of service members, of United States military service members, have basically open access to Florida's K-12 scholarship program. So a child of a military service member can apply and obtain any of the scholarships at any time, regardless of income. And we, from the FCCB's perspective, we're really excited about this because we have a lot of schools that are very close to military bases. I know there's a couple in the Panhandle. I remember growing up down in Tampa, I had a lot of friends whose parents were in the military. We have a lot of schools that have high military populations there, and as well as in Jacksonville and other places in the state. And so I think we'll have a lot of schools that could benefit from instituting a program like this. So we're really grateful for the sponsors for bringing it forward. And that's a great program. We're excited about it.
As a representative, Andrew Learned and Senator Tom Wright, who led the charge on that. Okay. Well, I suppose if we have to, you know, to talk about something that did pass that we were not as supportive of, that really we did not support at all, had to do with ostensibly the safety of religious institutions, which is really concealed carry of weapons on school campuses. Maybe I could say a little bit about this one to start, but obviously concealed weapons permit holders do abide by the law. They get extra training. They know what to do. And they do have generally access to bringing their firearms to church as long as the church does not have a policy against that and communicate that policy. So, you know, there have been a number of churches, you know, in the wake of a number of school shootings or church shootings over the last few years that have actually invited some of their members to provide security, at least to be ushers, to stand in the back, to make sure, you know, people are safe when they're at church. I would say, I think in our Catholic churches, there's been a policy throughout most of the state to require that only sworn officers can provide armed security in churches. That's not uniformly absolutely the case, but that's the strong preference, and that's almost universally the case. But questions would often arise in the last few years in the legislature about those churches that are located on the campus of a school, because there is a prohibition, even for concealed weapons permit holders, against bringing a weapon onto a school campus. You know, there were some efforts to ensure that churches that wanted to get people to provide security could carry those weapons across the campus into the church. And the legislature did pass a law that does allow people who are concealed weapons permit holders to bring those weapons onto any religious institution campus unless the property owner prohibits that. So, you know, the strong preference uniformly among superintendents of Catholic schools, and there'll be some more reflection on this before the next school year, has been not to have concealed weapons permit holders carrying weapons on campus, especially to provide security. Now, this legislation does not limit this just to times when school's not in session or to weekends when there might be a large number of people attending Mass, when a collection's being taken up. So it's a bit broader than we think it should have been, for sure. And we'll be doing some reflection on how to ensure that our school families know about the relevant policies for the schools that relate to this law.
I think you kind of said it all. I think it's... Luckily, there's still the ability for schools to develop their own policies, but at the same time, it would have been better if this was left as it was, so that schools had the choice to opt in if they wanted to allow concealed carry on campus rather than have an opt out of the policy.
And we don't expect this to be the case in Catholic schools in Florida, but you know, you almost worry that there might be some schools that allow their teachers to carry during the course of the school day, and that might just create some security concerns. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. Now, I know for a lot of parents, particularly of teenagers, sexual education is often a hot topic. I think we had some legislation that does give parents greater access to understand what some of those courses are going to be like for their kids. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about House Bill 545, Senate Bill 410.
Sure. So this is a bill sponsored by Representative Linda Cheney and Senator Ana Maria Rodriguez that addresses an issue that I think a lot of people have kind of heard about from parents and things like that, but also an issue that's really important, and that's sex education. And it's important for parents to be able to know what schools are teaching in regards to sex education. And what this bill does is it increases transparency and requires schools to be forthcoming about what type of sex education curriculum the school is offering and the instructional materials that they're using. And so this bill requires public schools to provide a link on their website for parents to go to so that they can review the sex ed curriculum that their student will be receiving. And this is important because under current Florida law, parents have the right to opt their children out of sex education if they don't like the type of sex education that their child would be receiving in public schools. And what this bill does is it increases the transparency over what the sex ed curriculum is so that parents can make that decision and make an informed decision about how their child will be educated in regards to sexuality. This bill also requires public school districts to approve sex education curriculums every year at a publicly noticed meeting. And so just generally, this bill does a great job of requiring the public school system to be transparent about how they're educating students about sexuality. And that's something that, you know, just anecdotally, I think a lot of people have heard about different situations where individual schools or school districts may not have been very forthcoming about what was in their sex education and what was being used. This bill does a great job of increasing transparency and allowing parents to make an informed decision and enter into informed discussions about this issue.
Well, Mike, another one of the bills that passed this session was the Fairness in Women's Sports Act, sponsored by Representative Kaylee Tuck and Senator Kelly Stargell. Certainly a hot topic these days, you know, as we question in the policy realm gender identity versus biological sex. But the legislature, I guess, made a determination as to how they want to proceed with respect to sports here in Florida.
Yeah, the most hot button of hot button issues, for sure. And this bill, so what this bill did is it basically said that athletic teams that are reserved for specifically for biological females that biological males are precluded from participating on those teams, regardless of a person's gender identity. Yeah, that's pretty much the gist of the bill. It's limited to high schools and public colleges and universities. It includes intercollegiate, interscholastic, intramural, and club sports. And the thing that this bill does is it recognizes that biological sex is real, that it's dichotomous, that there are biological males and biological females, and that there are biological differences between males and females lead to performance advantages in sports.
You know, there are lots of dimensions to this policy that was adopted. I think, you know, it's disputed as to what's the best response clinically for young people who are experiencing feelings of gender dysphoria or other related experiences that would prompt them to want to participate in a different sex. There are different long-term ramifications for trying to take that approach to transitioning. But I think for now, really, the legislature limited its focus to biological sex and requiring that athletic participation in these areas will be based on that. So I think that there's so much to it. We should probably spend some time breaking this down, reflecting on it in a separate podcast episode. But it's a bill that we did support. And we do believe that it, along with the other bills we've discussed today, will be signed by Governor DeSantis. So
I was just going to say, we're really thankful to Representative Tuck and Senator Stargell for sponsoring these bills. This is not an easy issue to carry. It's really difficult to talk about. And they both did it really well. And we're grateful for them for taking up this issue.
We think that's a good bill, and we're confident that it, along with all the bills we've talked about today, will be signed by Governor DeSantis. Well, good stuff, Mike. It was a very full session. A lot of things happening in the educational realm. We're really excited for so many of these things that are going to be going into law. And just congratulations to you, and thanks for sharing with listeners today.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here. And it was a great first session. Really grateful to be here at the conference, and looking forward to the next session.
As we continue our legislative wrap-up, I'm really pleased to be joined by Ken Knietman, Associate for Health here at the Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops. Just concluded regular session number two in the books for Ken. I'm really excited to have Ken on the team and ready to hear more about some of the key activities that happened in the realm of health. So, Ken, glad you're on here.
Glad to be here too. And even though it was my second session, I have to say it felt like the first because of COVID. It was so different from the one before that it was really in many respects a completely new experience of the legislative process.
Yeah, it's probably worth mentioning that, you know, the Capitol was shut down so much to such a great degree. I mean, you could get in there for House committee meetings on a limited basis. I think every third or fourth seat in a committee room is open. And then to testify in a Senate committee, you had to be at the Civic Center, the Tucker Center.
And even there, admission was limited. So it was there were a lot of constraints on really the normal ways that you have access to legislators and even people, other advocates, people that you work with and run into on a regular basis. So just the normal means of communication around session, the way information travels and moves, were all of that was really significantly hampered this year.
I know we're going to talk about a few things that relate back to just policy matters too, involve this too. So why don't we start? We just heard a little bit from Mike Barrett about an issue that relates to participation in sports by girls in girls sports and boys in boys sports. But and some of these questions about gender ideology or gender identity maybe lend well to some of the discussion of the Parents' Bill of Rights legislation that's been passed and is headed to the governor.
It really is an issue, Michael, with all the transgender and issues that are just continue to bubble and advocates really continue to push really hard. It is really crosses right over into the Parental Bill of Rights. And the Parents' Bill of Rights is really just a simple thing. In many respects, it just parental rights are are articulated in the statutes in a number of different places. And the Parental Bill of Rights, what it does is it brings them all together in a cohesive place. So parents are really able to go to the Florida statutes and look in one place and find the statutes that are relevant, that tell them what their rights are as parents. So it does that. That piece is not really anything new, but it does also speak to some responsibilities that public entities have when they interact with parents. And the part place where that really has intersected with much of the transgender activist agenda, if we would put it that way, is really in the school environment, where some things are being taught or they're being engaged with students and parents are just not aware of it. And school and some school districts in some occasions have really played a little game of hide the ball from parents and really don't trust parents and don't inform parents of things, sometimes on a very personal basis, of a very personal nature, about what's going on with their children. And the parents' Bill of Rights just really fundamentally says, listen, these public institutions where they interact with our children, they are not our co-parents. That is, parents have the right to know what's going on with their children. And it's been really a pretty long battle. I think this was the 9th or 10th year that the Parental Bill of Rights was introduced in the legislature, but it came across the line this year with really a great deal of support.
And it does make sure parents know where they can engage, what they can know, both within education and I think in healthcare, and some healthcare decisions that have been, worked through in the courts to, you know, develop some policies as a result of case law, but now they're going to be in statute as well. So.
And one of the things that the Parental Bill of Rights does is it just requires transparency. It requires that information be available to parents. And that's really an important part of the entire conversation, is that parents do have a right to know what's going on with their kids.
Good stuff there, Ken. And I guess that was Representative Aaron Grawl was the sponsor in the House, and then Senator Ray Rodriguez in the Senate. So. And we spoke a bit about the pandemic. I know that the pandemic did prompt the Agency for Healthcare Administration to allow a new type of staffing in nursing homes, because some of the exigencies that related to staffing in nursing homes and establishing a primary care assistant role that's now going to continue. I think they found it to be fruitful.
Well, they certainly did, Michael. And I think one of the things that is not uncommon, and nobody will be really surprised to understand, is that if you have a weakness somewhere in an organization or in a system, if there's a public health emergency or really any kind of emergency, what happens is that emergency really exposes where those weaknesses already are. And we already knew in terms of nursing homes in Florida that we had some critical shortages of certified nursing assistants, who are some of the primary caregivers in nursing homes. We already knew that. And when the pandemic came along, it just exacerbated that. We had CNAs who obviously went out with COVID, people who just didn't want to stay in the field because it was just so difficult. It was really a difficult season. People had PTSD. And so what the Agency for Healthcare Administration did was say, we're going to institute this new class of employee called a personal care attendant, that they can help in a nursing home with non-clinical activities. So they can pick up a remote off the floor if a resident has dropped a remote, or they can refill a water glass, or they can help them get to the restroom as needed. All of these non-clinical functions. And it really did save the nursing homes in many respects during the pandemic. And the bill this year, sponsored in the Senate by Senator Aaron Bean, and in the House by Representative Sam Garrison, really just took that emergency order and codified that into statute to make it an on-the-job training pathway for people who enter into the PCA program to have an opportunity while they're working, while they're earning a living, to prepare for and prep in order to take the CNA licensure. So it's really a good program all the way around.
Well, I know sometimes in a session, you know, there are a lot of competing goods that bump into each other. I know that there was some effort to increase Alzheimer's disease education among healthcare providers, all that, while there are a lot of continuing education that has to happen. I know that some of the health ministries had active engagement and some concerns about some of the proposals that were floated and ultimately did not become enacted. But I'd like to say a little bit about that situation.
Sure. As with anything in what we might characterize as the dance of legislation, is that there are folks who are proponents of a position, and then they put that forward. And really, that when the process is unfolding in a really organic and productive way, then all of the stakeholders, the people who provide those services or other people who might have an interest in that issue, they come together and they work through and find the common ground and really develop what hopefully is a good piece of legislation. And we had a couple, I think, really well-intended pieces of legislation around dementia and Alzheimer's related care this year, but they really, for whatever reason, didn't really get through that good process. And so there were a lot of concerns on the part of particularly healthcare providers who are already doing a substantial amount of training, who are already just in this area, as well as a number of other areas, who are just not comfortable with what had been proposed. And so those bills just, you know, they kind of got heavy as it got late in session because they just didn't get sorted out early enough in the process. And so those didn't come across the line this year. I fully expect that we'll see something next year. Hopefully it'll have a little bit better process a little bit earlier, and we'll be able to put together a bill with some dementia training that really makes sense and is helpful and really at the end of the day serves both the people who work with Alzheimer's folks and for folks who have Alzheimer's and dementia related illnesses.
Yeah, it's always good to get that balance and not have either side overreach and that kind of thing. So yeah, we'll see. This will be back next year. We'll be working on that again. That'll be good. So you mentioned that as we were talking about personal care attendants, that as this pandemic wore on, Ken, I know that you had a lot of involvement with the health ministries and trying to help them to adjust their approaches to providing care, to responding to the challenges of the pandemic. They certainly had a lot of additional costs. There were federal programs that were aimed to help them, but you know, did not do the complete making them whole that's hoped for. And then I know as we began the session, revenue estimates were low. We're going to be insufficient to be able to, you know, keep reimbursement rates the same for the folks who really bore a lot of the burden for responding to the challenges. So how did the health budget end up unfolding?
Well, it was a journey. And I have to say, Michael, if I could just preface this part of the conversation a little bit, is that early in the pandemic, if we think back, we remember when the governor asked all the hospitals to clear off all of their elective surgeries. So in waiting for that coming first surge of COVID patients, which really never came. And the financial hit to hospitals, even just in that one little silo, so to speak, was substantial. And it was really painful for a lot of hospitals to take that hit along with just the ongoing care issues that they had. And yet, as I was working with Catholic hospitals across the state and with other Catholic healthcare entities as well, I never heard them really talking about those financial issues. What they were consistently focused on was doing the right thing. What are we supposed to do? What can we do to help? And really every step of the way I've seen in this last year, Catholic healthcare entities really even ahead of emergency orders and doing things that, you know, they're rolling out programs on Monday that a week later the governor is talking about in an emergency order. And so it's been a really edifying experience with Catholic healthcare in Florida in the last state in Florida in this last year. Now that said, when the House and Senate first rolled out their budgets, because eventually budget time comes around when session gets here, they were problematic to put it gently. Nursing homes were looking at a 2% cut. Hospitals were looking at as much as a $250 million hit to Medicaid base rates. And so we were advocating very early on for the restoration of those funds. And at the end of the day, thanks in no small part to the governor really resisting the legislature's desire to implement some level of cuts, that both hospitals and nursing homes were held completely harmless this year, that the base rates that they had last year stayed in place for this year, which was certainly doesn't even begin to make them whole from the losses that they incurred last year. But it's not, you know, it's not injury on top of pain. And so we were really grateful at the end of the day to see those budgets at least held steady.
And weren't they helped a lot by some of the federal funding that became available to states through the American Recovery Program?
They were. There were two things that actually kind of saved the day financially. The first being that the revenue estimates, the tax revenue estimates from the state came in much better than they expected. So the legislature had more general revenue dollars to work with. But there were billions of dollars from the federal relief packages that came into the state that definitely helped fill in those gaps.
Well, hey, as we're talking about the budget, the health bucket at the conference also pulls in environmental kinds of health concerns. So the governor really made a promise early in his administration, I guess his first year, to try to make sure that we did some good things for the environment and that we invest in Florida's natural resources. It's another good year for the Everglades restoration efforts.
It was. The governor rolled out last year a $2.4 billion four-year environmental package. It was largely focused on Everglades restoration, which includes everything from the Lake Okeechobee area and even a little bit north of that, all the way down into Florida Bay across the entire Everglades. So that $600 million per year that they had projected stayed in the budget for this year. In addition to that, they added, which was really a speaker and a president, Speaker of the House, President of the Senate priority, a sea level rise and resiliency project that's going to be about $100 million a year. And this is just to help begin to look at some of these issues around really climate change, where we have rising sea level waters, we have more problems with coastal flooding when we have high tides or when we have a lot of rain, and just to begin to work through some of those issues and the environmental impacts of those things. Now, unfortunately, part of this project came on the back of a reduction in funding for affordable housing in Florida. It was really a tough pill to swallow, that we're having to trade one good for another, especially when we know that affordable housing is really such a priority and a difficulty in Florida right now.
Yeah, we had actually testified in support of both proposals separately, you know, full funding for affordable housing, and then, yes, please do undertake this resiliency project. And then
I think we actually testified in favor of both of those bills on the same day.
The legislature at least saw fit to advance both those projects to some extent. So we can be thankful for that. Well, and Ken, thanks for a lot of good work this session. Anything else stand out? Any parting remarks on just the healthcare activities?
I think the only thing that I would close with is it really is amazing what Catholic healthcare looks like and what it does, and its focus on mission and serving people and really attempting to work in that framework of loving people and taking care of people and doing the right thing on a consistent basis, even in the midst of the most difficult of circumstances. So I think for me personally, that may have been the most just encouraging thing I've witnessed over this last year.
That's great, Ken. Well, hey, well, thanks for that point and for all the good work on behalf of the health ministries and on behalf of the church in the public square, really to promote the common good here in Florida. So congratulations, another session in the books. Thanks for all you've shared today.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.